Chapter 51. The Duke of Northumberland was very anxious to keep the young king's death a secret, in order that he might get the two princesses into his power. But the Princess Mary, being informed of that event as she was on her way to London to see her sick brother, turned her horse's head and rode away into Norfolk. The Earl of Arundel was her friend, and it was he who sent her warning of what had happened. As the secret could not be kept, the Duke of Northumberland and the council sent for the Lord Mayor of London and some of the aldermen, and made a merit of telling it to them. Then, they made it known to the people, and set off to inform Lady Jane Grey that she was to be queen. She was a pretty girl of only 16, and was amiable, learned, and clever. When the lords who came to her fell on their knees before her, and told her what tidings they brought, she was so astonished that she fainted. On recovering, she expressed her sorrow for the young king's death, and said that she knew she was unfit to govern the kingdom, but that if she must be queen, she prayed God to direct her. She was then at Sion House, near Brentford, and the lords took her down the river in state to the tower, that she might remain there, as the custom was, until she was crowned. But the people were not at all favorable to Lady Jane, considering that the right to be queen was Mary's, and greatly disliking the Duke of Northumberland. They were not put into a better humor by the Duke's causing a vintner's servant, one Gabriel Poe, to be taken up for expressing his dissatisfaction among the crowd, and to have his ears nailed to the pillory, and cut off. Some powerful men among the nobility declared on Mary's side. They raised troops to support her cause, had her proclaimed queen at Norwich, and gathered around her at the castle of Framlingham, which belonged to the Duke of Norfolk. For she was not considered so safe as yet, but that it was best to keep her in a castle on the sea coast, from whence she might be sent abroad, if necessary. The council would have dispatched Lady Jane's father, the Duke of Suffolk, as the general of the army against this force, but as Lady Jane implored that her father might remain with her, and as he was known to be but a weak man, they told the Duke of Northumberland that he must take the command himself. He was not very ready to do so, as he mistrusted the council much, but there was no help for it, and he set forth with a heavy heart, observing to a lord who rode beside him through Shoreditch at the head of the troops, that, although the people pressed in great numbers to look at them, they were terribly silent. And his fears for himself turned out to be well founded. While he was waiting at Cambridge for further help from the council took it into their heads to turn their backs on Lady Jane's cause, and to take up the Princess Mary's. This was chiefly owing to the before-mentioned Earl of Arundel, who represented to the Lord Mayor and Alderman, in a second interview with those sagacious persons, that, as for himself, he did not perceive the reformed religion to be in much danger, which Lord Pembroke backed by flourishing his sword as another kind of persuasion. The Lord Mayor and Alderman, thus enlightened, said there could be no doubt that the Princess Mary ought to be queen. So, she was proclaimed at the cross by St. Paul's, and barrels of wine were given to the people, and they got very drunk, and danced round blazing bonfires, little thinking, poor wretches, what other bonfires would soon be blazing in Queen Mary's name. After a 10 days' dream of royalty, Lady Jane Grey resigned the crown with great willingness, saying that she had only accepted it in obedience to her father and mother, and went gladly back to her pleasant house by the river, and her books. Mary then came on towards London, and at Wanstead in Essex, was joined by her half-sister, the Princess Elizabeth. They passed through the streets of London to the Tower, and there the new queen met some eminent prisoners then confined in it, kissed them, and gave them their liberty. Among these was that Gardiner, Bishop of Winchester, who had been imprisoned in the last reign for holding to the unreformed religion, whom she soon made Chancellor. The Duke of Northumberland had been taken prisoner, and, together with his son and five others, was quickly brought before the council. He, not unnaturally, asked that council, in his defense, whether it was treason to obey orders that had been issued under the Great Seal, and, if it were, whether they, who had obeyed them too, ought to be his judges? But they made light of these points, and, being resolved to have him out of the way, soon sentenced him to death. He had risen into power upon the death of another man, and made but a poor show,
as might be expected,
when he himself lay low. He entreated Gardiner to let him live, if it were only in a mouse's hole, and, when he ascended the scaffold, to be beheaded on Tower Hill, addressed the people in a miserable way, saying that he had been incited by others, and exhorting them to return to the unreformed religion, which he told them was his faith. There seems reason to suppose that he expected a pardon even then, in return for this confession, but it matters little whether he did or not. His head was struck off. Mary was now crowned queen. She was 37 years of age, short and thin, wrinkled in the face, and very unhealthy. But she had a great liking for show and for bright colors, and all the ladies of her court were magnificently dressed. She had a great liking too for old customs, without much sense in them, and she was oiled in the oldest way, and blessed in the oldest way, and done all manner of things, too in the oldest way, at her coronation. I hope they did her good. She soon began to show her desire to put down the reformed religion, and put up the unreformed one. Though it was dangerous work as yet, the people being something wiser than they used to be, they even cast a shower of stones, and among them a dagger at one of the royal chaplains who attacked the reformed religion in a public sermon. But the queen and her priests went steadily on. Ridley, the powerful bishop of the last reign, was seized and sent to the Tower. Latimer, also celebrated among the clergy of the last reign, was likewise sent to the Tower, and Cranmer speedily followed. Latimer was an aged man, and, as his guards took him through Smithfield, he looked round it, and said, "This is a place that hath long groaned for me." Apostrophe, for he knew well what kind of bonfires would soon be burning. Nor was the knowledge confined to him. The prisons were fast filled with the chief Protestants, who were there left rotting in darkness, hunger, dirt, and separation from their friends. Many, who had time left them for escape, fled from the kingdom, and the dullest of the people began, now, to see what was coming. It came on fast. A parliament was got together, not without strong suspicion of unfairness, and they annulled the divorce, formerly pronounced by Cranmer between the Queen's mother and King Henry VIII, and unmade all the laws on the subject of religion that had been made in the last King Edward's reign. They began their proceedings, in violation of the law, by having the old mass said before them in Latin, and by turning out a bishop who would not kneel down. They also declared guilty of treason Lady Jane Grey for aspiring to the crown, her husband for being her husband, and Cranmer for not believing in the mass aforesaid. They then prayed the queen graciously to choose a husband for herself as soon as might be. Now, the question who should be the queen's husband had given rise to a great deal of discussion, and to several contending parties. Some said Cardinal Pole was the man, but the queen was of opinion that he was not the man, he being too old, and too much of a student. Others said that the gallant young Courtenay, whom the queen had made Earl of Devonshire, was the man, and the queen thought so too, for a while, but she changed her mind. At last it appeared that Philip, Prince of Spain, was certainly the man, though certainly not the people's man. For they detested the idea of such a marriage from the beginning to the end, and murmured that the Spaniard would establish in England, by the aid of foreign soldiers, the worst abuses of the Popish religion, and even the terrible Inquisition itself. These discontents gave rise to a conspiracy for marrying young Courtenay to the Princess Elizabeth, and setting them up, with popular tumults all over the kingdom, against the queen. This was discovered in time by Gardiner. But in Kent, the old bold county, the people rose in their old bold way. Sir Thomas Wyatt, a man of great daring, was their leader. He raised his standard at Maidstone, marched on to Rochester, established himself in the old castle there, and prepared to hold out against the Duke of Norfolk, who came against him with a party of the Queen's Guards, and a body of 500 London men. The London men, however, were all for Elizabeth, and not at all for Mary. They declared, under the castle walls, for Wyatt, the Duke retreated. And Wyatt came on to Deptford, at the head of 15,000 men. But these, in their turn, fell away. When he came to Southwark, there were only 2,000 left. Not dismayed by finding the London citizens in arms, and the guns at the Tower ready to oppose his crossing the river there, Wyatt led them off to Kingston upon Thames, intending to cross the bridge that he knew to be in that place, and so to work his way round to Ludgate, one of the old gates of the city. He found the bridge broken down, but mended it, came across, and bravely fought his way up Fleet Street to Ludgate Hill. Finding the gate closed against him, he fought his way back again, sword in hand, to Temple Bar. Here, being overpowered, he surrendered himself, and 300 or 400 of his men were taken, besides 100 killed. Wyatt, in a moment of weakness and perhaps of torture, was afterwards made to accuse the Princess Elizabeth as his accomplice to some very small extent. But his manhood soon returned to him, and he refused to save his life by making any more false confessions. He was quartered and distributed in the usual brutal way, and from 50 to 100 of his followers were hanged. The rest were led out, with halters round their necks, to be pardoned, and to make a parade of crying out, "God save Queen Mary!" In the danger of this rebellion, the queen showed herself to be a woman of courage and spirit. She disdained to retreat to any place of safety, and went down to the Guildhall, scepter in hand, and made a gallant speech to the Lord Mayor and citizens. But on the day after Wyatt's defeat, she did the most cruel act, even of her cruel reign, in signing the warrant for the execution of Lady Jane Grey. They tried to persuade Lady Jane to accept the unreformed religion, but she steadily refused. On the morning when she was to die, she saw from her window the bleeding and headless body of her husband brought back in a cart from the scaffold on Tower Hill, where he had laid down his life. But, as she had declined to see him before his execution, lest she should be overpowered and not make a good end, so, she even now showed a constancy and calmness that will never be forgotten. She came up to the scaffold with a firm step and a quiet face, and addressed the bystanders in a steady voice. They were not numerous, for she was too young, too innocent and fair, to be murdered before the people on Tower Hill, as her husband had just been. So, the place of her execution was within the tower itself. She said that she had done an unlawful act in taking what was Queen Mary's right, but that she had done so with no bad intent, and that she died a humble Christian. She begged the executioner to dispatch her quickly, and she asked him, "Will you take my head off before I lay me down?" He answered, "No, madam," and then she was very quiet while they bandaged her eyes. Being blinded, and unable to see the block on which she was to lay her young head, she was seen to feel about for it with her hands, and was heard to say, confused, "Oh, what shall I do? Where is it?" Then they guided her to the right place, and the executioner struck off her head. You know too well, now, what dreadful deeds the executioner did in England, through many, many years, and how his axe descended on the hateful block through the necks of some of the bravest, wisest, and best in the land. But it never struck so cruel and so vile a blow as this. The father of Lady Jane soon followed, but was little pitied. Queen Mary's next object was to lay hold of Elizabeth, and this was pursued with great eagerness. 500 men were sent to her retired house at Ashridge, by Berkhamsted, with orders to bring her up, alive or dead. They got there at 10 at night, when she was sick in bed. But, their leaders followed her lady into her bedchamber, whence she was brought out bedhams next morning, and put into a litter, to be conveyed to London. She was so weak and ill, that she was 5 days on the road. Still, she was so resolved to be seen by the people, that she had the curtains of the litter opened, and so, very pale and sickly, passed through the streets. She wrote to her sister, saying she was innocent of any crime, and asking why she was made a prisoner. But she got no answer, and was ordered to the Tower. They took her in by the Traitor's Gate, to which she objected, but in vain. One of the lords who conveyed her offered to cover her with his cloak, as it was raining, but she put it away from her, proudly and scornfully, and passed into the Tower, and sat down in a courtyard on a stone. They besought her to come in out of the wet, but she answered, that it was better sitting there, than in a worse place. At length she went to her apartment, where she was kept a prisoner, though not so close a prisoner as at Woodstock, whither she was afterwards removed, and where she is said to have one day envied a milkmaid whom she heard singing in the sunshine as she went through the green fields. Gardiner, than whom there were not many worse men among the fierce and sullen priests, cared little to keep secret his stern desire for her death. Being used to say, that it was of little service, to shake off the leaves, and lop the branches of the tree of heresy, if its root, the hope of heretics, were left. He failed, however, in his benevolent design. Elizabeth was, at length, released, and Hatfield House was assigned to her as a residence, under the care of one Sir Thomas Pope. It would seem that Philip, the Prince of Spain, was a main cause of this change in Elizabeth's fortunes. He was not an amiable man, being, on the contrary, proud, overbearing, and gloomy, but he and the Spanish lords who came over with him, assuredly did discountenance the idea of doing any violence to the princess. It may have been mere prudence, but we will hope it was manhood and honor. The queen had been expecting her husband with great impatience, and at length he came, to her great joy, though he never cared much for her. They were married by Gardiner, at Winchester, and there was more holiday-making among the people, but they had their old distrust of this Spanish marriage, in which even the Parliament shared. Though the members of that Parliament were far from honest, and were strongly suspected to have been bought with Spanish money, they would pass no bill to enable the Queen to set aside the Princess Elizabeth and appoint her own successor. Although Gardiner failed in this object, as well as in the darker one of bringing the Princess to the scaffold, he went on at a great pace in the revival of the unreformed religion. A new Parliament was packed, in which there were no Protestants. Preparations were made to receive Cardinal Pole in England as the Pope's messenger, bringing his holy declaration, that all the nobility who had acquired church property, should keep it, which was done to enlist their selfish interest on the Pope's side. Then a great scene was enacted, which was the triumph of the Queen's plans. Cardinal Pole arrived in great splendor and dignity, and was received with great pomp. The Parliament joined in a petition expressive of their sorrow at the change in the national religion, and praying him to receive the country again into the Popish Church. With the Queen sitting on her throne, and the King on one side of her, and the Cardinal on the other, and the Parliament present, Gardiner read the petition aloud. The Cardinal then made a great speech, and was so obliging, as to say that all was forgotten and forgiven, and that the kingdom was solemnly made Roman Catholic again. Everything was now ready for the lighting of the terrible bonfires. The queen having declared to the council, in writing, that she would wish none of her subjects to be burnt without some of the council being present, and that she would particularly wish there to be good sermons at all burnings, the council knew pretty well what was to be done next. So, after the cardinal had blessed all the bishops as a preface to the burnings, the Chancellor Gardiner opened a high court at St. Mary Overy, on the southern side of London Bridge, for the trial of heretics. Here, two of the late Protestant clergymen, Hooper, Bishop of Gloucester, and Rogers, a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.